Welcome back to that Optimism Man podcast, where optimism is more than a mood, it's a movement. I'm Victor Perton, that Optimism Man, and today's guest is an unapologetic optimist who lives through practical optimism. Julian Mather has been an army sniper, a magician, a documentary filmmaker, and now a speaker on change and leadership. He's someone who turns risk into reward, failure into fuel, and life's curveballs into creative opportunities. In this episode, Julian invites us into his world of practical optimism, a mindset of action in the face of uncertainty. His mantra? Own up, wise up, step up. He shares stories of building a career on curiosity, of winning a golden guitar with music videos, and of near-death experiences that dissolved his fear and unlocked his boldness. You'll hear life experience born of reflection, from gratitude practices beside his bed to hidden time capsules designed to inspire future generations with wonder, possibility, and yes, optimism that the world is better than they thought it was. Julian says that extraordinary people are simply ordinary people who do extra. So if you're listening to this and thinking you're just ordinary, then good news from Julian, you're already in the game. This is one of these conversations that may shift something inside you. So lean in, take notes, and prepare to be challenged, uplifted, and inspired by the bold, clear voice of an optimist on a mission. Here's Julian Mather. Julian Mather, welcome to that Optimism Man podcast.
I am stoked to be here, full of optimism, lots to share.
Well, that's why we're talking. So let's start off. Everyone who visits the Centre for Optimism gets that same first question. What makes you optimistic? Is it that life experience, your faith, your mindset, the facts or the people around you? Julian, what makes you optimistic?
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, why don't we start with the facts? I mean, you know, I adhere to the scientific process. I love that. And like some of my great influences in, you know, my life have been books and the facts like Factfulness by Hans Rosling, Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World, The Constitution of Knowledge by Jonathan Rauch. I mean, these books paint a picture of the world which is at odds, which we are told by the general media. And when you go and look at the facts, it's actually uplifting. I mean, sure, we've got a troublesome world, but it is a pretty good world. So that's the facts. Then I think my mindset, I think you're born with an optimistic mindset. Victor, I mean, it's like... Viktor Frankl, let me talk. Yeah, Viktor Frankl, you know, Man's Search for Meaning. He was in a Nazi concentration camp. He said, you can do whatever you want to me, but you can't have my mind. And he was always in complete control. So that mindset that I'm always in control. And then faith is, I'm actually opposite. I'm atheist. Well, actually, I've started calling myself agnostic in respect to a lot of smart people I know who are people of faith. And I go, well, you know, who am I to say that, you know, that I know it all? So I've softened my position to agnostic. But I've had three experiences where I've almost died. I went over the handlebars of a motorbike in a head-on collision. And I remember this overwhelming force as I went, and then I blacked out. And then I fell 40 feet off a cliff onto my head. Verily, luckily, there were two rocks. One was the size of a microwave oven and the other was the size of a TV set. And it was a gap in the middle and my head went right into the gap. Again, I felt this overwhelming force, but I blacked out. And then I electrocuted myself. I had a stove, an old electric stove that had a clock in it, and it used to tick really loudly, tick, 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 and it drove me crazy. I thought, I'm going to fix this. So I got a screwdriver, and I started taking it apart, but I didn't know that it was live. And it zapped me and threw me back across the room into the wall behind me. This time I didn't black out. I was awake for every electrifying moment of that little sucker. But the point was, was that there was no pain in all of this, and I blacked out. And so I've lost my fear of death. In the sense that, I mean, I could have, you know, I don't know. I haven't died, so I can't say definitively, but I think it's a pretty good approximation of what would happen to me when death happened. And there was no pain and it wasn't scary. So I've lost that fear, and that boosts my optimism. It just means, you know, go out and try more, try a little bit harder. You know, chances are, you know, even if it doesn't go right, it's not going to be a bad exit. So, I mean, generally, maybe that's facts, mindset, and faith,
and life experience.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I love that journey beyond fear is what my friend John Hagel wrote about in a book called The Journey Beyond Fear, and okay. Hagel talks about the pillars, which are curiosity, and I know you're a very curious man, yeah. And optimism.
Right, so, okay.
So we come back to those two books you mentioned, for instance. I mean, Hans Rosling's Factfulness. I was in Toronto recently, and I was talking to a group of teenagers who were being very negative. And so I went out into the bookshops of Toronto to look for a copy of Factfulness, and I couldn't find one in any of the new bookshops. And finally got to a second-hand bookstore and asked whether he had it. And he said, no, if I could get it, I'd get it. And as I'm walking out of the shop, there's a pile of 9 of them on a table. So, of course, I went and bought all 9. And I think there was almost a sacred message to me. You're going to find this and give it to the teenagers. And so what did you find fascinating about Rosling and Factfulness?
I mean, I thought the whole book was wonderful, but the intro where he tells those stories of going into large organizations around the world, like into The Hague, into large organizations in the European Union, educational institutions, and these people who are driving, you know, international policy. And then he posed these very simple questions to them. He's got a series of about 10 questions about how do you think the world operates? And they're very, very simple questions. And he asks these questions, and it's something like 8 or 9 out of the 10 questions. The answers are always wrong from these very smart, very intelligent, very influential people. And that was my starting point because, you know, I mean, just as a regular sort of guy out on the street, sometimes I think, well, maybe I'm just dumb. You know, maybe I just don't understand. And then when you find out that, you know, all these people who you aspire, you know, in your thinking towards, they suffer from the same ignorance, the same blind spots. So, you know, there's hope for us all. And again, this comes back to optimism.
Yeah, and Rosling's questions are designed to show them that they're actually wrong about the world, and they're wrong by being too negative rather than being too positive. And I do love Rosling's work, and of course his children are continuing it. The other one, of course, I think very important for those who haven't read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning is, of course, the addendum, which you referred to, that chapter on tragic optimism, where he basically says, look, if you're in a concentration camp or you're living in Australia as you and I are, just do your best. So what's your takeaway from Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning?
Oh, just it keyed into so I spent some time in the army, and I ended up being an army sniper for a couple of years. And one of the things I used to do was they would put us in a helicopter and you'd send you out in the middle of nowhere and just drop you off at night by yourself. And as you go out, they go, have you got your rifle? Check. Have you got your radio? Check. Have you got your mirror? Check. And what they used to do is give us these little polished steel mirrors, and you would use them for basic things like, you know, having a look, having a shave, putting some camouflage on and stuff like that. But this particular unit I was with, the reason they gave us the mirror was they said that if you ever need to solve any problems, ask the man in the mirror, because he's the one who's going to solve them for you. And so this idea of personal responsibility, of digging deeper, of self, of agency, you know, was already in my thinking. So really when I, you know, read, you know, Viktor Frankl's, you know, Man's Search for Meaning, it just tied into this, really, I probably haven't even scratched the surface of maybe potentially what, you know, is possible. Although I got to say, I really don't want to be in that situation to test it.
When I give lecture, last week I gave keynote speeches in two water conferences. And at one of them, I did have a pen and I went into the bathrooms. And on the mirrors, I wrote, "The leader looks like the person in your mirror." So I think what you just said sparks with me. So I often, and in fact, I'll get audiences to get up and look into the eyes of the person next to each person and say,
"I'm writing that down, Victor."
Yeah,
sorry, keep
so talking. You can use it because people love it and they start laughing. And I say, tell the person next to you, look into their eyes and say, "The leader looks like the person in your mirror." And if I do get the chance, I do visit the bathroom before I speak and actually write it on the mirrors.
That's what I thought you meant, which I think is way more powerful. I love that.
So, no, that's a good... Anyone who wants to try that, any of you listeners, on your mirror, the mirror at work, write down, "The leader looks like the person in your mirror." And you won't need to be dropped from a helicopter with that mirror to make the decision. You'll have it there right in front of you.
Now, Julie, that reminds me of that... Sorry, just let me jump in here. That reminds me, did you ever see The Truman Show?
Yes, indeed. I thought it was a documentary.
Yeah, it's like that. But remember when he drew in the bathroom mirror the astronaut's helmet and, you know, you saw himself as the astronaut in the reflection? That reminds me of that.
So Julian's going to use that and the rest of you are welcome to use it too. Now, we've talked before and you've described yourself as an unapologetic optimist, I should say, who lives through practical optimism. So do you want to unpack that for us? What's an unapologetic optimist?
I'm unapologetic is that there is this overwhelming, we're talking about it before, about the message that the media gives out, the message that advertising gives out. I mean, advertising works on shame. Media works on fear, and there's almost this, and I know that you use the word Pollyanna-ish, connotation to being optimistic. And I go, no, I'm not apologizing. I think you're wrong. It's the same as when I'm in a room and a cynic speaks up. So, right, you know, you're having a discussion, everyone puts their points of view forward, then right at the end of the meeting, there's that person at the back of the room with their arms folded who speaks up and says, tells you why it can't be done. And they normally got a very convincing argument, and I let them finish, and then I go, boo to the cynics, boo to the cynics. That is lazy. Cynicism is lazy. Come up with a better argument than that. So it's, I've got off track there, stating your case and giving people alternatives. Just one of the things I do for my own personal benefit, is listen to people who have done it before. So let's say, Warren Buffett, you know, what does Warren Buffett tell us all the time? Do the opposite of what everyone else is doing. So he talks about investing. So, you know, when everyone else is selling, that's when you buy. When everyone else is buying, that's when you sell. So I've taken that on board and it's helped me with opportunities. So I'll give you a concrete example here. When I worked in television, there was a country music video clips that had to be made, and they were made down in Tamworth during the country music festival. And there was no money to do it and nobody wanted, to take these on. And so they were just sitting there. You had to go down for a week and make seven videos in 7 days. And because nobody else wanted to do it, I immediately shot my hand up and said, there's an opportunity. I don't know how this is going to play out. So there was no money. So what did I do? When I was working out, I remember sitting out in Longreach. We were working out there on a documentary. It came to a Sunday morning. We'd have one day off a week. And I was sitting in some little motel in Longreach with a little TV set in the corner. I remember they used to have music like clips on a Sunday morning or something. So I sat there with my notebook and I watched all these music clips while everyone else was out on a river cruise somewhere. And I just drew every little idea that I saw from these music clips. And I went, right, so all I've got to do is go down for these 7 days and I've got to use, okay, I could use 5 or 6 of these in one video for every day. I don't know which ones I'm going to do. And that's what I did. I went down there. That's the short of it. The long of it is I ended up winning a golden guitar at the Australian Country Music Awards. And it was sort of random. It was the first year that they'd had a video clip category, and basically no one else put anything in. And they were horrible videos, but I won. So there you go. There's opportunity, and it's learning. Practical opportunity is actually learning to see opportunity. Opportunity for me is physically like this thing, like I literally sort of see it, and I see all these other people walking past it, and I go, take it, but they can't see it. And so it is a learned process to be able to see opportunity. You just grab it and you take it. And then one of the other skills of practical optimism is learning to fail. Because when you become good at failure, which I am, then you're not scared to have a go at these opportunities where you don't know which way they're going to go. So my process is fail quickly, fail quietly, repeat. I build a pipeline of different projects. I very rarely am working on one thing at a time. I've always got other things going. So if one fails, I just shut it down, quietly, don't say a word about it, and go on with another. And I don't know what the ratio is, but it's probably, one win out of every 2, 3, 4, 5 that I do. But I've learned, again, this has just given me so much optimism. I'm 64 now. I don't see myself slowing down for ages. I just see so many other things that I can be doing, whether it's, and the reward that I get out of it, whether that's financial, whether it's emotional, whether it's spiritual, whether it's educational. There is just so much opportunity out there.
Yeah, that notion, the scientific notion on this is that pessimists can't innovate.
The pessimist
ground down by what went wrong, who's at fault, I'm at fault. So listeners, if you want to build a team for innovation, exactly as Julian has just said, you've got to pick the optimists. And people tell me, for instance, Twiggy Forrest famously said, look, I won't have pessimists around my board table. I can buy them for $1,000 an hour from law firms and accounting firms. And Dyson, the vacuum cleaner guy, often speaks about 5,000 iterations of the bagless vacuum cleaner before he achieved commercial success. So I think that's a 1-5,000 ratio, Julian.
Yeah. And, that's the dirty secret, isn't it, is that people don't talk about luck. One thing I know is that you go into any establishment with successful business people and ask them how they got to where they are. They'll say, I got there on merit. I got there under my own steam. Give them a couple of glasses of wine and ask them the same question. And they'll tell you, I was really lucky at the same time. And, again, most people don't understand this. And if you understand that luck really does play a big part in this, of course you have to work hard. Of course you have to set yourself up to take the opportunity if it comes your way. But it's also comes down to the flip of a coin so many times. And again, this is why you need to build a pipeline of ideas, because it's just not going to go your way as hard as you work and as good as you think you are. And I love that saying, the rooster shouldn't take credit for the sun rising. Just be a little bit more humble about your success.
Well, I doubt that we'll ever convince roosters not to crow in the morning. So who have been, you've been in the military, You've been in media. I mean, you've done a very interesting array of things. And as you said, you're not going to slow down. I think you'll be like Henry Kissinger, who was keeping working till he was 99. So who have been the inspiring leaders and role models in your life?
Okay, very unsung heroes. You're just talking about Henry Kissinger there, and so my grandmother, my nanan, she was started to learn Japanese when she was 87 years old. You know, she was so. I mean, I've had this influence, and it's really funny. I didn't acknowledge that until yesterday. Actually, I was speaking to someone else. And this woman asked me what role my grandparents played. And I went, you know, I've never actually sat down and thought about it. And when I went, oh, my grandmother, she really was influential in my life. But so it is small people. Sister Anne Marie Jensen. Sister Anne Marie. Okay. So Sister Anne Marie was a Catholic nun working in a retirement village on the Gold Coast in Queensland. Living a very, very quiet, simple life. And then on the notice board in this retirement village in was the no no sorry in the magazine that came out from the Queensland Catholic Archdiocese, there was a position coming up for a priest who was retiring who used to fly out to Western Queensland. Anyway, this ad came up, and month after month after month after month, and a year passed by, and she thought, I don't know, maybe I should put my hand up. Now, this is a little Sister Anne Marie. I mean, she's about 5 foot nothing. She's a, you know, like a spatchcock. There's hardly anything on her. And so she puts her hand up, and she, I mean, she's a sister. She's no, there's a hierarchy in the church. She shouldn't be doing this. Anyway, they say, yeah. And she's never flown a plane before, so she learns how to fly. She has no idea how to do radio calls. So she's in the old people's home, she's cooking them dinner, and she's got the potato peeler. She's peeling potatoes, and she's using the potato peeler as a microphone and practicing her radio calls to the tower. And all the old folks would, you know, do the replies to her. And then she ended up in this position flying through outback Queensland. She was known as the Flying Nun, and no surprise there. She, her area she flew over was the same size as Germany, but you know, instead of having many, many, you know, hundreds of millions of people, she had something like 1,500 people. And I said to her, "Are you scared flying over this, you know, big area out there?" And she said, "You don't get it, do you?" She said, "Yeah, I'm not scared of crashing. I'm scared of being found if I crash." But, you know, so, and she worked, and she was on the back of a flatbed ute out there and helping lay irrigation pipe, you know, the big black irrigation pipe, and it comes in rolls. And there was an end of the roll sticking out where it had been taped, and they went through a gate, and the end of the pipe caught the fence post and tensioned and then whipped back and smashed her in the face. She ended up in hospital for a year getting her whole face rebuilt. Soon as that was done, she was back out there. So it's these sort of people who just their courage, their resilience, their mindset just fill me with that sense of possibility. Wow, if they can do that, what am I, you know, capable of? There was Frank the Builder. Frank the Builder up in Redcliffe in Queensland. Frank built shopping centres. He was a hard hat sort of a guy with a theodolite over his shoulder and a roll of plans under his arms. And then a job came in to build the largest Taoist temple outside of mainland China. And Frank went, "Oh, it's a bit of a laugh. I'll put a quote in. You never know." Anyway, he got the gig. So he ended up out on the mud flats in Deegan outside of Brisbane with two Taoist masters who had flown in from China in their robes and their toe sandals. And he's out there on the mud flats. And they look around and they grab two sticks, and they put these two sticks in the mud, and they said, "Align the temple to this axis. It is the perfect axis between the energy of the mountains and the sea." And off they went. And Frank went, "Right. Oh, yeah, as if." Anyway, Frank got curious, so he went back to his office and started researching this and got out all the maps. And what do you think? It was the exact access everything they'd said. Well, anyway, Frank got curiouser and curiouser, and the short of it is, Victor, Frank became a Taoist monk.
Mm.
Frank swapped his meat and vegetables for a vegetarian. He swapped Catholicism for Taoism, and he swapped his builder's boots for toe sandals. So there's this, all these people, these simple people that I've, you know, had the privilege to meet, who have influenced me and gone, my, I am capable of so much more. And you know, the thing is, you don't, one of the great things I learned from being a documentary cameraman is that extraordinary people are ordinary people who do extra. And the key is, they are ordinary people. This always surprised me, because unlike, you know, shooting news where you go in and you're there for an hour or so and you never see them again, with documentaries, I might be there for a day, I might be there for a week, sometimes repetitive over years. And people let their guard down. You just see, you know, behind the scenes. And these extraordinary people that we all think are these, you know, amazing people we look up to, we give them too much credit. They are just regular people like you and me, and they find some skill or some trait, and they work really, really, really hard at it. And they have a lot of failures along the way, and, you know, and luck as well. And sometimes a few of them raise up. But the key to that ramble I just went through was that, to begin with, they are ordinary people. So if you're listening to this and you're an ordinary person, you are in the game. You are honestly in the game. What you, the only person who doesn't realize it yet is you. So you've got to change a few of these stories in your head.
Yeah, and storytelling and narrative. Now, this week you published Julian's Manifesto. And of course, what drew my attention to it, number one, was unapologetic optimism. Do you want to tell us about Julian's Manifesto, what inspired it, and why optimism is number one?
Yeah, Simon, I hope you're getting a sense of why optimism is number one already. But the manifesto itself is that I always find I operate best through clarity. And so I have... all through my life tried to gain that clarity, and it's really only in the last 10 years or so that I've really started to apply myself seriously to this and work out, who am I? What do I actually think? If I could distill it down to just a handful of ideas of the type of person I am, number one, that gives me clarity. It is like rocket fuel. So when I go out into the market, when I'm talking to you here now, I'm not concerned about, I'm not worrying at all about what I say. Am I going to get it perfect on that? Because I know who I am, and I'm a person who serves. And for most of my life, I never was, Victor. I was a person who was doing it all for me. And I've learned and I've made this transformation. So this manifesto was 6 points about what I know about myself, and I'm an unapologetic optimist. And we're just talking about before is, you know, the media says it's all bad, you know, we're told the world is a worse place, and it is. And I don't buy that. I don't agree with it. And I'm going to stand up and say, I think you're wrong with it. So I'm unapologetic with that. And then there's other points in there that I found out about myself. I'm a raging introvert. For most of my life, I was behind the camera, and I was watching all these amazing people in front of the camera effect change in the world. And I felt small. I felt embarrassed that I didn't have the confidence. I was mystified. Like, how did they do this? What did they know? So for a lot of my life, I thought, and I thought you had to be an extrovert to do this. And I've learned since I've come from behind the camera to being in front of the camera, and from started my life as a stutterer, and now I'm a speaker, and since I've been on the stage, I am absolutely gobsmacked by the number of people who are thought leaders, presenters, you know, people in the public eye. The majority are introverts. And just to be clear, you know, an introvert is someone who gets their energy from themselves, from their thinking, loves living in the cave. But I've learned a skill to be able to do this and to go on stage and present. But once I'm done, I want to go back to my cave and be by myself. Extroverts are people who get their energy from other people and who love going out into a social situation and talking to everyone, and it fills them with this. Whereas me, I go into a social situation, I was just trying to work out what to say, you know, like it is exhausting. I just want to go home after I've been there 20 minutes. So, I don't know where that was going.
That was your manifesto. So, as you said,
emphasize
things
down
to a sentence or two. And, yeah, at the Center for Optimism, we've now done 10 years of research into leadership and optimism. And last year, my chairman, Rob Masters, and I worked on synthesizing our 10 years of research into one sentence. And we call it the Optimism Principle. And we say the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. The answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. Do you agree? And if so, has that idea shown up in your work and life?
You know, I don't know. I don't know whether I agree or not. I don't disagree. I haven't thought it through in whether that is the answer. But what I do know is I do know that humans will work it out. I'm a humanist. I have such belief in the collective human ability. And so we continually paint ourselves into corners, but we always seem to get ourselves out. And I don't see that changing. I hear all the people kicking millennials and Gen Zs, and I go, what are you talking about? Okay, they are like they are now, but they're going to take over the reins and inherit the world soon. And they will get on board and they will work it out. So is it optimism? Is that the answer? I don't know. But having said that, I mean, I always know that you need grown-ups in the room as well. And so this idea of optimism, sometimes, you know, people criticize it as being Pollyanna-ish. I do acknowledge that you do need grown-ups, like you were, you know, an MP. You need people in who are going to make hard, rational decisions so we can all move forward. One of the things I say in my manifesto is I'm a radical centrist. I mean, I believe that the truth lives in the middle and, you know, the a dogma and, you know, all lives at the extremes, and people love that. I believe it's, you know, nuance and is courage to go into the center. Because when you look at that historically, you know, that's what they used to, the kings in the courts always used to do. Anytime they went into conflicts, you kill the people close to you in the courts who aren't all on board. You kill your closest enemies first. So that's why I say it's a radical centrist, because people go, oh, you're a fence sitter. I go, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. I just don't see the world in black and white like you do, which is one of the reasons I ended up in documentaries and not news and current affairs, which is very black and white view of the world. I'm a nuanced person. So,
again, about your language, you know, you talked about the person leaning forward to try and correct or to put the opposite. And one of the bits of language you use is yes and. And often when I'm not just doing optimism, I'm doing public policy, I talk about the notion of appreciative inquiry. So instead of that critical analysis, the always the but, and but shuts people down. The moment you say but, they know you're about to sort of hammer them. And I love that notion of yours of yes and. Do you want to tell us more about that?
Oh, yes and is very simple. So that's... Yeah, I mean, that's the comedy principle of what's the comedy where you all just get on stage and you don't know what's coming
improvisation
next.
Improvisation.
Improv. So, I mean, that's the basis of improv. Whatever is put at you, you agree and you go and you follow on. So you're always continuing building and expanding the argument. And again, there's that word expand, you know, like expand. I want to expand optimism. I want to grow hope that's out there. So I typically, if I'm answering online, you know, in a chat response, whatever people say, I go, yes, and blah, blah, blah. So it helps reflect criticism, you know, deflect criticism coming back at me, because I don't want to be stuck down a rabbit hole dealing with that. But it, I think it's a kind thing to do, to acknowledge people that go, okay, well, that's a point of view. And I mean, I do try to read, and then just, have you thought of this as well? It is a practical way of expanding optimism.
I think it's very powerful. I love appreciative inquiry, and I love future orientation. You know, that notion that, and I understand you've hidden time capsules all over the place.
Yeah. So
what's in your time capsules, and who are you hoping are going to look at them?
Okay, so my house I live in is an old Queenslander. I've been here about 33 years. I basically stripped this place bare and have rebuilt it. And I was so disappointed because I kept on going, oh, I'm going to pull this up or pull that off, and I'm going to find something, even if it's an old newspaper, an old pound note, something. And I found nothing, and I was so disappointed. And so I thought, oh. So as I rebuilt this place, I thought of the people in the future. I thought, wow, imagine if 100 years' time somebody's doing this house and they were tearing down this wall and they found something inside, because I was desperate. So simply, I would, as I'm going and I'm building a wall, before I sheet it over, I get my, you know, builder's pencil out and I write, hi, Julian here again. This is the date. I'm married. My kids were, 12 months and, 22 months old now. The sun is shining. The sun feels warm on my skin. The breeze. It's an autumn day. And I just talk about what it's like to be alive now, because I've always been mystified by historical footage. You know, when you go back to black and white footage, you go back to World War II, and you see, it seems a different place. It seems a different time. And I'm fascinated by that, because as a documentary cameraman, I went to war zones. And I was just so surprised. But war zones aren't like you think they are. like stuff happens over there, but right here, life goes on as normal. People are opening up their shops and selling their jeans and selling their coffee. This comes back to this human aspect, this collective power of humanity to keep going and to rebuild. So these time capsules go from simple jottings inside a wall to getting a glass jar, like a big pickle jar, and then I just get old, you know, photos of my family in the house, tear off a page of a newspaper. I used to do that, can't do that now. But just make these time capsules and put them in there. So I put one in about 12 months ago, and I had some old books that my father had when he was a child, and they were all falling apart. And my father had actually helped me build this wall, which I was, again, rebuilding. So I made a time capsule about my father. I put these books in there. I got photos of him, other bits and pieces of him, and I wrote a story. And I put it in there and sealed it up. And someone is going to open this and go, huh? What is this? And they're going to unwrap it, and it's wrapped, and they're going to—it's like sealed and sealed and sealed. And they're going to wrap, and they go, "Whoa, snake! Come over here, have a look." And there you go. And so people in the future are going to be filled with a sense of wonderment, possibility, maybe even opportunity, and maybe a little optimism that the world is a better place than they thought it was.
Some senses, you know, you bring to mind that old song, A Message in a Bottle.
Yeah.
So you think a lot about optimism. It's number one on your manifesto. So what are your favourite daily tips, tools or habits to help you stay optimistic, but that you can share for our listeners today?
Okay, so there's two things in the world that I know I'm good at. One is video, and the other is change. I have made many changes, and that's what I speak about now. As a motivational speaker, I speak about helping people embrace change in an ever-changing world. Because if you want to be valued, be valuable. And so resisting change is actually is not good for your career. So I have a process, and I keep this little thing in my pocket all the time. Hang on, wrong pocket. Oh, no, it's in this pocket. Here it is. There, that's it. Ah, Right. So I use this every day of my life. Own up, wise up, step up. Own up, stop blaming people for where you are and take responsibility for where you're going. Wise up, you can't win a new game playing by old rules. It's time to get into the habit of learn, unlearn, and relearn. And step up. A daily dose of mild discomfort makes massive goals manageable. Everything you need to do is just break it down into little doses of daily mild discomfort. So this is what I use to give you an absolute practical example. And I kid you not, everything I've done, and if you go and look at my career history and all the things I've done, has been based upon that. Doing little things daily over a longer period of time and having some luck and a bit of time in there as well. But the number one thing, and I do this every day, I own up. I stop blaming people for where I am and I take responsibility for where I'm going. How do I do that? I have a piece of paper next to my bed and it has this written on it. My job is the dream of the unemployed. My house is the dream of the homeless. My smile is the dream of the depressed. And my health is the dream of those who are sick. It's an old thing. I saw it on a coffee, you know, in a coffee shop on a board, and I copied it down and I've been using it for about 6 years now. Every morning I look at that and I went, man, you've got no complaints. Just get over it and get on your bike, right, and start getting into the day. So that's actually, you know, a really practical example of tools that I use.
And that that notion of gratitude, you know, that expression you picked up in the coffee shop. I read that Stephen King, you know, the horror writer,
yeah,
every morning he does a similar exercise to you. Jewish rabbis, again, they do a gratitude prayer before they get up in the morning. So listeners, that is a great piece of wisdom from Julian, that notion being grateful for what you've got. But can you just again, so if you can conjure up, folks, so Julian holds up his thumb for principle number one, and then index finger, next finger. Give us those three principles again, Julian.
So it's own up, wise up, step up. Own up. Stop blaming people for where you are and take responsibility for where you're going. Wise up. You can't win a new game playing by old rules. It's time to get into the habit of learn, unlearn, and relearn. And then step up. A daily dose of mild discomfort makes massive goals manageable.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, Julian, you've been so generous. How can people stay in touch with your work? You're a public speaker. What are the best ways for people to follow what you write, what you say? And then if they need a motivational speaker like you, you know, a life from an army sniper to a cameraman, you know, all sorts of opportunities you've taken over the years. So what are the best ways for people to stay in touch with your work and your thinking and to engage you when they need a motivational speaker?
So I'm very lucky. All my handles are at Julian Mather. So I'm on LinkedIn at Julian Mather. Find me there. My website is julianmather.com. Everything's there. And I actually today just started a Substack today, and I got Julian Mather on that as well. So it'll be Substack. It'll be my website. And just let me tell you, you know, like I was talking about different things that I'm doing and like this sense of possibility. I've just started up, I'm building this new process. I'm a first-time granddad, and my little grandson is 6 months old, and I absolutely have fallen in love with him, and I want to be a real part of his life. And so I want to be the best granddad that I can be. That's aspirational. So I've started bestgranddad.com, and this is an aspirational site where I'm going to invite people to join me on my journey as I learn to be the best granddad. So, you know, like these are all, this is all this possibility out there, and you don't have to ask. I didn't have to ask anybody to do that. There's so many people still think it's the old way of doing things. Like there's a gatekeeper and there's a process and you have to be the anointed one, my my son, yes, go forward. It's not like that anymore. It hasn't been like that for 5 or 10 years. You can just show up with an idea and you can just do these things. I think that's a really nice way to end on, to get that, you know, to fill people with that sense of possibility that there's much more available than they're actually aware of.
I had a funny interaction yesterday. Someone was objecting to the use of the word fair. And this morning, someone posted on Twitter an old video of Milton Friedman, the economist. And he said, You know, fairness implies someone else is making a decision about you. Freedom says you're making the decision about you.
Right, yes, yeah.
And it's interesting. I'd never thought about that. You know, being a lawyer, you know, you always think of these notions of fairness and justice and the like. But it was very interesting yesterday to have this person object to the use of that word and then to see Milton Friedman today, you know, right back from the 70s talking about that. Julian, you are wonderful. I just so enjoy your energy, your rules, your principles, your manifesto, and to be an unapologetic optimist. As you know, I'm a radical optimist. My gender pronouns are Pollyanna optimist. So it is just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful being with you, an unapologetic optimist. Julian Mather, thank you for joining us on that Optimism Man podcast.
Thank you.
What a delight. And Julian Mather, what a force of practical optimism. From Mirrors in the Jungle to Gratitude Notes Beside the Bed, Julian's life reminds us that optimism isn't wishful thinking. It's a daily choice, a courageous strategy, and a creative discipline. He's shown us that being an unapologetic optimist is not only possible, it's powerful. So to Julian, thank you. Thank you for your honesty, your stories, your time capsules, and your call to own up, wise up, and step up. You're a beacon of what it means to turn risk into opportunity and action into meaning. And to you, our listeners, if this conversation sparked something in you, I encourage you to follow Julian's work. Find him at julianmather.com, Julian Mather on LinkedIn, and on his brand new Substack. And if you're on your own grandparent journey, check out bestgrandad.com for a dose of intergenerational optimism. And if you want to keep the optimism flowing, I warmly invite you to join us at the Centre for Optimism. Subscribe to our updates, explore our resources, and share your voice. Because optimism grows stronger when we build it together. You've just spent time with two unapologetic optimists, and if you're listening, chances are you're one too. So until next time, own up, wise up, step up, and stay boldly optimistic.